into two of each of the B-52's eight engines, thereby allowing the aircraft to get off the ground faster than the hour or so it usually takes. Black smoke billows out. All remaining engines are started. One by one, each of the bombers joins the ominous elephant walk formation down the tarmac. One by one, they gain speed and take off. At Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri, the B-2 nuclear bombers prepare to roll out of their hangars, taxi down runways, and take to the air, which leaves the boomers, the nuclear-armed, nuclear-powered submarines, the nightmare machines, the handmaidens of the apocalypse, the vessels of death, unlocatable by Russian missiles and therefore unstoppable, nuclear-armed to the teeth. The Navy controls a fleet of 14 of them, 12 of which are said to be in operation at any given time in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. That two of them are always being overhauled in dry docks, one on the East Coast, at the Naval Base in Kings Bay, Georgia, the other on the West Coast, at the Naval Base in Bangor, Washington. In this moment, there are 10 boomers at sea. Four or five of those are thought to be on hard alert, Christensen and Korda report, that the other four or five boats could be brought to alert status in hours or days. Every individual in every nuclear command and control facility across America prepares for what is about to happen. They are not preparing for war fighting. They are preparing to annihilate the other side and for their own, almost certain, pending deaths. FEMA will not send out any more messages. America's 332 million plus citizens will now be left completely in the dark. 51 minutes, NATO air bases, Europe. At minute 51 in this scenario, at NATO air bases across Europe, in Belgium, Germany, the Netherlands, Italy, and Turkey, the pilots who have been waiting inside hardened aircraft shelters, ready for combat, now receive orders to launch. The special alarm sounds, says retired F-16 Air Force pilot Colonel Julian Chestnut, formerly stationed at the nuclear-capable NATO base in Aviano, Italy. The scramble order comes down, the order that alerts pilots to nuclear mission. Russian SLBMs are coming for them. In a matter of minutes, they will strike. NATO's nuclear bombs come out of the WS-3 vaults. They are loaded onto NATO aircraft. NATO pilots know their bases are a primary target, aviation journalist and former second lieutenant in the Italian Air Force, David Senciotti tells us. They know they have to get up into the air fast, that what they are now facing amounts to suicide missions. Nuclear mission pilots have a single target, maybe a secondary one, says Chestnut, who was once awarded the Silver Star for gallantry in combat. And each nuclear pilot knows everything about his or her one route. You train and train on that. You've memorized every ground feature of note. You're assuming your GPS has been jammed, and you're working entirely on inertial navigation and map memory. Overflying Russia to drop a nuclear gravity bomb means facing down Russian radar systems. NATO aircraft are not stealth like the B-2 bomber. Russian radars can see you, Chestnut says. They can track you and will likely shoot you down. And since there's no way to defeat the Russian radar, you have to fly really low. as in just a couple of hundred feet above the ground. NATO pilots are trained for nuclear war. Chestnut describes a Cold War tactic. Just a few miles off target, you pop up and release your nuclear weapon. There's a parachute attached to it that slows down the bomb as it falls. The bomb falling by parachute allows NATO pilots a little extra time to try to get out of the area, to try and beat the nuclear blast wave. Newer model nuclear bombs glide to the target without a parachute. They have to get extremely close to the actual target, Sensiotti clarifies. Most NATO pilots accept there is little hope of realistic return. You burn a lot of fuel at low altitude, Chestnut tells us, thousands of pounds of gas an hour. So by the time you get on target, you're running out of fuel. There will be no U.S. Air Force tanker available for mid-air refueling. You have to assume your fuel tanker is shot down. Nuclear war is final, Chestnut says. And besides, he adds, after delivering a nuclear weapon, you'd have to ask yourself, is there anything you really can come back to? With launch orders from the UK Prime Minister and now also from the acting President of the United States in place, across Europe, NATO pilots race down the tarmacs and take to the air. 52 minutes, Pyongyang, North Korea. 32 U.S. submarine-launched nuclear warheads, transported by MIRV Trident missiles and guided by star sighting, arrive on their targets in North Korea a little over 14 minutes after emerging from beneath the sea in the Pacific, somewhere north of Tinian Island. The destruction of Pyongyang, North Korea's capital city, is absolute. A majority of the city's 3 million residents are incinerated. Each W-88 nuclear warhead strikes its designated target with a precision that Sandia National Laboratories in New Mexico has boasted publicly about for decades. The warhead always works when we want it to, and never when we don't, program manager Dolores Sanchez says of the W-88. The arming, fusing, and firing assembly are the brains of the warhead, and a Sandia warhead is very smart. The W-88 warheads have a yield of 455 kilotons each. The bomb that destroyed Hiroshima was 15 kilotons. Nagasaki was 21 kilotons. The amount of explosive power that strikes North Korea in this scenario is almost too much for the mind to comprehend. As President Kennedy once remarked after a briefing on likely nuclear death tolls, and we call ourselves the human race. MIRV stands for Multiple Independently Targetable Reentry Vehicle, which means very little to most people, and certainly nothing to the millions of people that MIRVs will kill. And yet it has meant quite a lot to nuclear war planners and defense analysts over decades past. A MIRV, like its acronym states, is a weapon system that carries multiple nuclear warheads in its warhead bus, each one capable of striking an independent target, including ones hundreds of miles apart. If MIRV minutia seems like too much detail to consider when the world is about to end, it is important because it helps explain how fast global nuclear war unfolds. How tragic and ironic it is that human beings developed slow and steady over hundreds of thousands of years, culminating in the creation of vast and complex civilizations, only to get zeroed out in a war that takes less than a few hours from beginning to end. Since the 1960s, when MIRVs first came to be, an estimated hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent designing, developing, expanding, and perfecting MIRV technology, on industrializing and mass producing MIRVs. And then, after the arms reduction talks of the 1980s, the world's nuclear experts decided MIRVs were destabilizing to world peace. And so, tens of billions more U.S. taxpayer dollars were spent de-MIRVing the MIRVs. This step, proclaimed the U.S. Defense Department in one of its nuclear posture reviews, will enhance the stability of the nuclear balance by reducing the incentives for either side to strike first. After thousands of U.S. MIRVed ICBMs were designed, built, siloed, and pointed at the other side, it was decided a MIRVed missile in an underground silo was too lucrative a target. The logic went like this. If one ICBM in, say, Wyoming contained 10 warheads in its nose cone, that silo was, or could be, seen as too tempting of a target for an enemy to destroy with a preemptive nuclear strike. Lots of arguments later, the MIRVs were disarmed, dismantled, deconstructed, disposed of. Some of them were destroyed. But only the MIRVs on land. In the submarines, the nuclear missiles were deemed okay to remain MIRVed for a strange logic that went like this. A nuclear submarine is not really a target because it can't be located, it being stealthy and under the sea. And so, missiles on Ohio-class submarines have remained MIRVed. And now it is a legion of these MIRVed tridents that strikes North Korea in the first U.S. nuclear counterstrike against the nation that recklessly and foolishly, and why we simply don't know, started nuclear World War III in this scenario. In the words of John Ruble, a mass extinction event is underway. The first nuclear bombs to hit North Korea strike the supreme leader's known residences in and around Pyongyang. These palaces and villas double as military headquarters and are therefore considered by U.S. war planners to be central components of North Korea's nuclear command and control. Residence number 55, the central luxury mansion in the Yongsong district, is hit. The leader's private train station, the man-made lakes, and the anti-artillery sites guarding the palace here, they all get vaporized in the nuclear bomb blast. The same goes for the horses waiting in the stables and the children swimming in the pool. Everything in a 3-mile diameter ring is mowed down, all the people incinerated, all things ablaze. This horror will happen 81 more times in the next few minutes. Residence number 15 in Chongsongdong district is struck. Its fireball destroys the adjoining Central Committee of the Party Complex, its cavern of underground tunnels and bunkers below. Residence number 85 in East Pyongyang is hit. Its fields of domesticated deer and fishing ponds are there one instant, gone the next. Residence number 16 in the Central District is obliterated, as is the party research facility and everyone working there next door. The Rakpo and Samsok residences in the western suburbs disappear in fire and blast, as does the lakeside residence at Kangdon, a summer retreat 19 miles north of Kim Il-sung Square. Mushroom clouds stretch out over the city and merge into a dense mass of particulates, of organic and inorganic matter, particles of humans and buildings and bridges and cars, all cremated on the spot. Between the fireballs, the blast, and the several hundred mile per hour winds, the city is flattened end to end. By nightfall, all 772 square miles of Pyongyang, known locally as the capital of the revolution, will be engulfed in a mega cyclone of fire that burns and burns until there is nothing left to burn. Gone is the city's Russian-style architecture, its high-rise apartment buildings, its orderly grid. Gone are Pyongyang's people on bicycles, on foot, in cars. People standing, sleeping, pausing, brushing their teeth are all killed in nuclear flash, fire, and blast. Nuclear weapons destroy everyone and everything in Kim Il-sung Square, in Mansudae Assembly Hall, in the 1st of May Stadium, the Juche Tower, the Arch of Triumph, the Rokgisong Hotel, also known as Building 105, the 105-story tall, unfinished, pyramid-shaped skyscraper designed as a middle finger to the West. Come nightfall, everything from the Sunan International Airport to the Korea Bay will be reduced to barren, smoldering soil. As in Washington, D.C., millions of people have been incinerated on the go, melted into streets and surfaces, sucked into hurricanes of fire. People have been impaled by flying shards and crushed under buildings. Everywhere, human beings are screaming and burning and hemorrhaging to death. The destruction, pain, and suffering here is identical to the destruction, pain, and suffering halfway across the world in the United States. And one must accept and understand that this is all but a speck of the mass carnage to follow worldwide. Across North Korea, 20 more nuclear bombs strike the nation's nuclear facilities. The Yongbyon Nuclear Scientific Research Center in the central northwest explodes in a nuclear fireball. This place houses a radiochemical lab, a uranium enrichment plant, and two nuclear reactors. And so precisely what happened in Diablo Canyon roughly 30 minutes ago now happens here. Nuclear core materials meltdown, the devil's scenario. To strike a nuclear reactor with any explosive weapon violates Rule 42 of the International Committee of the Red Cross. But nuclear war has no rules. If you win, you need not have to explain. With core meltdowns underway, and with the facility's spent fuel rods spewing out a radioactive witch's brew, the land here has also now become uninhabitable for an interminable amount of time. Along the country's northwest coast, the Sohae Satellite Launching Station and its ICBM engine test facility are struck with nuclear bombs. Sohae, located 70 miles northwest of Pyongyang, is just 30 miles from Dangdong, China, population 2 million. If China intended on staying out of this conflict, the sudden killing or wounding of hundreds of thousands of Chinese citizens will now drag China and its arsenal of 410 nuclear weapons into this rapidly unfolding, all-out nuclear war. In North Korea's northern region, a nuclear bomb strikes the Punhye-ri nuclear test site, where underground tests conducted between 2006 and 2017 allowed North Korea to transform purchased or stolen nuclear plans into the sprawling nuclear weapons program that started this war. Punhiri is 110 miles from the Russian border, with Russia's port city of Vladivostok just another 85 miles north. Kangsun, a clandestine uranium enrichment site along the Pyongyang-Nampo Expressway, is hit, as is Sino-ri, an undeclared missile base in the mountains. Sangnam-ni and Musudon-ri missile launching sites, also within range of the Russian border, are struck in rapid succession. In a few more minutes, an additional 50 ICBMs will strike North Korea, the 50 ICBMs that Russia mistook as 100 or more coming for them. In a matter of minutes, 82 nuclear warheads kill millions of North Korean citizens, none of whom did anything to bring any of this upon themselves. Same as the Americans killed minutes ago in Washington, D.C. and around Diablo Canyon did nothing personally to harm those now dead and dying halfway across the world. U.S. submarine-launched Trident missiles are a beast of a weapon system. The namesake, the Trident, is a three-pronged pole arm created by humans for spearfishing or for combat against other humans. We have no way of knowing which came first. How old the Trident actually is in conception, no one knows that either. Prehistoric for sure. Humans' ability to do science has helped humans refine killing, helped us evolve from a hand-to-hand warfighter to one who can push a button or turn a key and kill millions of people on the other side of the world. What will become of humanity after nuclear war? The dinosaurs had a 165 million year run. They came. They dominated, they evolved. Then an asteroid hit Earth, and the dinosaurs went extinct, not counting their descendants, birds. No trace of the killer reptiles was found by anyone that we know of for 66 million years, until just a few hundred years ago, in 1677, when the director of Oxford's Ashmolean Museum, Robert Plott, found a dinosaur femur in the village of Cornwall and drew it for a science journal, misidentifying the bone as belonging to a giant. After nuclear war, who, if anyone, will know we were once here? 52 minutes, Mount Pictou, North Korea. North Korea's leader is nowhere near Pyongyang. He is in a bunker 1,900 feet below Mount Pictou in Samgyeon County, North Korea. A bunker that is understood to be as close to being nuclear bomb-proof as any of the nuclear bunkers in Russia or the United States. Mount Pictou is an active stratovolcano that last erupted more than 1,000 years ago. Its emerald water caldera, called Heaven Lake, has long been entwined with state propaganda, in stories that require North Koreans to pretend its rulers are semi-divine. In this scenario, it is in this bunker beneath Heaven Lake Mountain where North Korea's supreme leader intends to ride out nuclear war. He may die in the process, but such is the life of a mad king. Après moi, le déluge. For decades, North Korea's leaders have constructed vast underground facilities, UGFs in military parlance, for themselves to hide out in before, during, and after a nuclear exchange. North Korea's UGF program is the largest and most fortified in the world, the Defense Intelligence Agency reported in 2021. Estimated to consist of thousands of UGFs and bunkers designed to withstand U.S. bunker buster bombs. This network of subterranean buildings is said to be connected internally by railways and roads, some with remote-controlled bridges and movable gates. "The entire nation must be made into a fortress," Supreme Leader Kim Il-sung publicly proclaimed in 1963. "We must dig into the ground to protect ourselves." Defectors recount stories of polished marble walkways, escape hatches, and tunnel shafts interconnecting these underground warrens. North Korea's leadership has enough food, water, and medical supplies, they say, to hide out underground for years or even decades. That these bunkers have backup generators and air circulation systems to allow the regime to remain alive, cut off from a post-nuclear war world for as long as necessary. That the supreme leader keeps with him a tunnel boring machine so that he can choose when, where, and how he will eventually dig himself out of the nuclear rubble. During the Cold War, when Russia was the country's main benefactor, Soviet scientists shared with their fellow communists the engineering techniques that made all this tunneling possible, that enabled North Korea to build some of the best underground fortresses in the world. In the 1960s, Soviet scientists used as a metric the fact that a U.S. bomber carrying a B-53 bomb with a 9-megaton yield could destroy a facility built down to 1,889 feet in wet soil or wet soft rock, which may explain why the bunker beneath Mount Pictou has been built 1,900 feet underground. It is 4:55 a.m. local time here at Mount Pictou. The supreme leader is briefed by his advisors about what is going on in the United States, how Washington, D.C. has been destroyed, how the devil scenario is underway on the California coast, how many people are dead. Like the president of Russia, North Korea's leader is said to obsessively watch news of the Western world on satellite TV. By now, just 52 minutes into this scenario, many channels have ceased broadcasting in the U.S., which means the leader's access to information is extremely limited. The North Korean military has no early warning system of its own, not in the air or on the ground. Communication in and out of Mount Pictou relies entirely on an embedded telephonic system, Michael Madden tells us, like the old-school landlines. The supreme leader only knows what is happening in his own country based on what his advisors, the personal secretariat, tell him is going on. Still, the supreme leader in this scenario all but expected Pyongyang to be leveled in a massive nuclear counterstrike. And he is not yet done wreaking havoc. He holds a wild card that he intends to use. Nuclear bombs cause other kinds of mass destruction when creatively applied. Now, North Korea's leader intends on settling a score. It has been nearly a decade since the West released that satellite image of the Korean Peninsula at night. The one with the northern half, North Korea, looking dark and foreboding with barely any electric lights, but with the southern half, South Korea, looking shiny and bright. To a mad king, this comparing image was like a poke in the eye. For weeks after the picture was released, in international news stories, the West ridiculed North Korea as being an electricity-poor country that was energy bankrupt. What happens next is revenge for that insult. North Korea's supreme leader is in possession of a nuclear weapon engineered to strip the United States of its energy, to show the world what electricity poor can really mean. For decades, the U.S. EMP Commission, formerly known as the Commission to Assess the Threat to the United States from Electromagnetic Pulse, EMP Attack, has been warning Congress about the catastrophic dangers of a nuclear weapon exploded directly over the homeland, in the upper atmosphere, or in space. The EMP Commission has, for decades, asserted that a high-altitude EMP attack will damage or destroy America's entire block power grid. The degree of danger this weapon poses to the U.S. has been the subject of vitriolic debate. This is the favorite nightmare scenario of a small group of very dedicated people, one pundit told NPR in 2017. At a congressional hearing that same year, empty threat or serious danger, assessing North Korea's risk to the homeland, the EMP Commission doubled down on its warning, submitting written testimony entitled North Korea Nuclear EMP Attack, an Existential Threat. Former CIA officer and the EMP Commission's long-serving chief of staff, Dr. Peter Pry, said in an interview for this book shortly before his death in 2022, "If North Korea detonates a high-altitude EMP over America, it's electric Armageddon. If." 52 minutes, 30 seconds. Redstone Arsenal, Huntsville, Alabama. Inside the Army Space and Missile Defense Command headquarters at Redstone Arsenal near Huntsville, Alabama, birthplace of America's ICBM, the commander watches on a radar screen as a North Korean satellite moves into position. The satellite in this scenario is similar to one launched by North Korea on February 7, 2016, and known as KMS-4, Kwangmyongsong-4, or Bright Star 4. In the West, the KMS-4 identifier was NORAD-41332, which allowed interested parties to track its orbit around Earth, which people did until June 30, 2023, when it fell out of orbit and decayed. NORAD ID 41332, International Code 2016-009A, Perigee 421.1 kilometers, Apogee 441.4 kilometers, Inclination 97.2 degrees, Period 93.1 minutes, Semi-Major Axis 6802 kilometers, RCS Unknown, Launch Date February 7, 2016. Source, North Korea, NKOR. Launch site, Yongsan, DPRK, YUN. As the commander here at Redstone watches the radar screen, he and everyone else in this room fear they are about to watch this satellite explode. Or, more precisely, watch the satellite detonate. That they are just moments away from witnessing what the EMP Commission has been warning various Senate and House committees about since its first report in 2004. That this kind of satellite might not be a reconnaissance or communications satellite, as North Korea has claimed, but a small nuclear weapon orbiting the Earth, ready to detonate on command over the United States in the ionosphere and destroy the entire U.S. power grid. It was in 2012 that high-altitude EMP fears widened beyond the commission and into the mainstream. That is when a NASA rocket scientist turned NBC News space consultant named Jim Oberg visited North Korea to investigate the idea that North Korea was developing an EMP weapon. Oberg was initially skeptical about what he'd heard. There had been fears expressed that North Korea might use a satellite to carry a small nuclear warhead into orbit and then detonate it over the United States for an EMP strike, Oberg wrote in the Space Review. Trained as a nuclear weapons engineer, Oberg says he initially thought these concerns seemed extreme and would require an astronomical scale of irrationality on the part of the regime. But after traveling to North Korea to examine the country's satellite control facilities and hardware, Oberg reported back that he'd changed his mind. He became convinced that what he saw, in fact, presented an existential threat to the United States. Oberg called it the doomsday scenario. The most frightening aspect, Oberg wrote of what he witnessed, is that exactly such a scale of insanity is now evident in the rest of North Korea's space program. That doomsday scenario has become plausible enough to compel the United States to take active measures to stop such a thing, Oberg warned. To make sure that a North Korean satellite capable of carrying a small nuclear warhead never be allowed to reach orbit and ever overfly the United States. But no actions were taken, and in February 2016, North Korea successfully launched this kind of satellite into space, a satellite with a payload big enough to carry a small nuclear warhead. North Korean officials insisted it was carrying a 470 megahertz UHF radio payload into orbit, designed only to broadcast patriotic songs to its citizens. And maybe it was. But the satellite's orbit was an unusual south-to-north orbit, one that allowed it to fly directly over the United States, including over Washington, D.C. and New York City. The following year, North Korea published a technical paper called The EMP Might of Nuclear Weapons, zeroing out the idea they were being assigned a military intention they did not possess. Oberg's doomsday scenario was lining up as possible. Behind closed doors, EMP commission officials again briefed Congress. Russia, China, and North Korea now have the capability to conduct a nuclear EMP attack against the U.S. All have practiced or described contingency plans to do so, the commissioners warned. This technology was now being referred to in open source literature as super EMP weapons. Writing in the Cipher Brief, a media outlet staffed by former directors of the CIA, DIA, NSA, and others, Pry got more specific. North Korea's satellites, he wrote, resemble a Russian secret weapon developed during the Cold War called the Fractional Orbital Bombardment System, FOBS, a weapon system that would have used a nuclear-armed satellite to make a surprise EMP attack on the United States. As EMP Commission Chairman, Pry was privy to information gleaned at a classified briefing in which two very senior Russian generals warned this super EMP knowledge had been transferred to North Korea, Congress heard. Ambassador Henry Cooper, former director of the U.S. Missile Defense Agency, went on record with his worst-case scenario fears regarding a high-altitude electromagnetic pulse detonated over the United States. The result could be to shut down the U.S. electric power grid for an indefinite period, leading to the death within a year of up to 90% of all Americans. In 2021, U.S. Strategic Command conducted more than 360 nuclear command and control exercises and war games. How many involved nuclear war with North Korea remains classified. How many involved high-altitude EMP weapons is also classified, as are all intelligence community reports on super EMP threats. But we know from Richard Garwin, architect of the first thermonuclear weapon and one of the longest-serving advisors to the Defense Department, that Mad King logic concerns U.S. nuclear command and control. In Mad King logic, in this scenario, it follows that North Korea's supreme leader wants to cripple the United States in an act of revenge, wants to set America back to a time before there was electricity, before modern weapon systems existed, before America had weapons of mass destruction and could fight push-button or turnkey wars. The Mad King in this scenario intends to set America back to pre-electric times, when it left other countries alone, when kings across the world had vast armies and fought their neighbors directly to reclaim conquered lands, all without the threat of America getting involved. North Korea's stated goal since the 1950s has been reunification with the South by force. And now, from deep inside a bunker beneath Mount Pictou, the Mad King prepares to detonate a high-altitude EMP weapon already flying in an orbit over the United States. He must wait for several more minutes for the space satellite to get into the exact right position. In the meantime, the Mad King in this scenario attacks Seoul. 53 minutes, Osan Air Base, Republic of Korea, South Korea. Inside an underground command bunker at Osan Air Base in South Korea, the U.S. commander stares at satellite images and video streams from surveillance drones keeping watch on the border with the North less than 50 miles away. Outside, on Osan's tarmac, most of the F-16 Fighting Falcons and A-10 Thunderbolts await combat. Some are already in the air, flying sorties over the Yellow Sea. Others remain lined up on the tarmac, waiting for launch clearance, waiting until after the attacking Trident nuclear missiles and incoming ICBMs finish their job against the North. The commander watches the screen. That North Korea hides its jet fighters in underground bases inside its mountainous terrain is well known to the U.S. military. And it hides road mobile launch vehicles in a similar fashion. North Korean ground forces operate thousands of long-range artillery and rocket systems along the entire length of the DMZ, wrote Defense Intelligence Agency analysts in a 2021 monograph, and that this is an ever-present existential threat. Collectively, this capability holds South Korean citizens and a large number of U.S. and South Korean military installations at risk, the Pentagon's intelligence agency warned. The North could use this capability to inflict severe damage and heavy casualties on the South with little warning. And in this scenario, it is about to. In a well-rehearsed salvo, out from its camouflaged bases, stream dozens, then hundreds, of North Korean launch vehicles. They move into position, stop, and begin firing off hundreds and then thousands of small and medium-sized rockets. In forested areas nearby, rail cars stop on their tracks. their tops slide open. Scores of Hwasong-9, Scud-ER, Scud-D, short-range missiles launch from out of these rail mobile launchers on a trajectory into the south. All at once, all headed for three targets, Osan Air Base, Camp Humphreys, and the center of Seoul. More than 10,000 artillery shells and 240-millimeter rockets fly toward South Korea in a colossal, coordinated mass casualty attack. The weapons of mass destruction loaded into these small rockets are not nuclear weapons, they are chemical weapons. North Korea has a chemical warfare, CW, program that could comprise up to several thousand metric tons of chemical warfare agents and the capability to produce nerve, blister, blood, and choking agents, Defense Intelligence Agency analysts warned in their 2021 report. The U.S. commander at Osan watches what is happening in real time. Outside, in a ring around the Osan Air Base, America's billion-dollar terminal high-altitude area defense system detects this barrage of incoming missiles. Its systems alert and react. THAAD's anti-missile missiles fire, but in vain. More than 10,000 projectiles coming in from the north are far too many for THAAD to engage. THAAD systems see a few of the Scuds and manage to shoot several of them down. But the smaller rockets firing out of the North Korean 240-millimeter launchers are just 9.5 inches wide, the diameter of a standard dinner plate. Too thin for the THAAD system to accurately identify, let alone engage, en masse. THAAD fails again and again. THAAD can handle one or a few missiles at a time, military historian Reed Kirby tells us. But Osan, Camp Humphreys, and Seoul are being targeted by thousands of projectiles filled with sarin nerve agent. In an article for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Kirby did the math on what would happen in what he terms a sea of sarin attack, basing casualty rates on a generalized application of how chemical weapons operate, using a likely overall rate of 10,800 rounds every 15 minutes, Kirby calculates, coupled with the fact that the sarin payload of each 240-millimeter rocket is known to be 8 kilograms per rocket, and while also taking into consideration misfires and duds, Kirby maintains that a 240-ton sarin attack on South Korea would inflict a 25% casualty rate on Seoul. The casualty numbers are horrific, between 650,000 and 2.5 million civilians dead, with another 1 to 4 million more injured. For survivors of a nerve agent attack, the outcome is gruesome. A fair number might enter a persistent vegetative state due to anoxia or lack of oxygen, Kirby says. 54 Minutes, Boyds, Maryland. In America, in the rural, unincorporated community of Boyds, Maryland, the president lies on the forest floor, bleeding out. He is helpless and forlorn. The creeks in the area flood this time of year, and he can hear the nearby rush and flow of water. The earth around him is cold and damp. He has wet himself from trauma and shock. Will anyone find him here? The president hears, or thinks he hears, the rotor blades on a quick reaction force helicopter circling overhead, looking for him. But the trees around him include evergreens, and the canopy is dense. They cannot and will not see him. In books about Vietnam, soldiers and airmen stuck in a similar position as he is now, stuck among the trees in the jungles of Vietnam and Laos, that is, were often rescued by daring helicopter pilots and crews. It was not just luck that saved these men, although luck can sometimes play a powerful part. Men in combat in Vietnam were taught to carry on their person a small piece of mirror, a means to signal for help should they get separated or lost. The president is not equipped with anything like that. Not since John F. Kennedy has a U.S. president seen combat. America's 21st century presidents have grown accustomed to being taken care of by teams of people who satisfy their every need. The president shouts in the forest, but no one can hear him scream. 55 minutes, Redstone Arsenal, Huntsville, Alabama. In Huntsville, Alabama, the commander is on his feet, watching what is happening on the radar screen in front of him. He is there at the moment when a satellite, similar to the KMS-4 satellite, Bright Star 4, all of a sudden explodes. There is only one thing to think in this moment, only one thing to say. North Korea just detonated a super EMP. The electricity surges, then ceases to flow. This is a military facility, which means backup generators kick in without interruption. But everyone here knows that generators run on fuel, and that the electric pumping of fuel has just come to a permanent and fatal end. 55 minutes, 10 seconds. The doomsday scenario. Inside the bunker, beneath Mount Pictou, North Korea's supreme leader is told that the super EMP weapon has detonated as planned. Like a nuclear sword of Damocles hanging overhead, it was hidden in a reconnaissance satellite overflying the U.S. on a south-to-north orbit all this time. The weapon exploded at an altitude of 300 miles above the United States, over Omaha, Nebraska. The doomsday scenario has come to pass. An electromagnetic pulse weapon detonated in the ionosphere does not harm people, animals, or plants on the ground. It is silent. In space, there is no atmosphere to carry sound. An EMP weapon causes no structural damage. For the millions of Americans sheltered inside the basements of their homes, had nuclear bombs not just destroyed Washington, D.C. and Diablo Canyon in California, the situation might seem like just another power outage at first. But this is not that. Stephen Wax, chief scientist for the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, an organization that began as part of the Manhattan Project, warned in 2016. A nuclear detonation at an altitude of 500 kilometers, 300 miles, over Omaha, Nebraska, will generate an EMP that covers the contiguous landmass of the United States. This super EMP delivers a three-phased E1, E2, and E3 electromagnetic shockwaves so powerful that industrial-strength surge suppressors and lightning arrestors designed to block high-voltage spikes are rendered useless all at once. The pulse passes through all but the most hardened military-grade safety devices as if they weren't even there, says Jeffrey Yago, an electrical engineer, military consultant, and advisor to EMP Commission Chief Dr. Peter Pry. An airburst EMP would be a devastating blow, America's former cyber chief, retired Brigadier General Gregory J. Toohill tells us, and that few people can really comprehend the devastating reality of EMP because they do not have access to the government's classified information. 26 years ago, I wrote a monograph about an EMP event, Toohill says. It's still classified. The high-altitude EMP weapon that just exploded over Nebraska in this scenario damages or destroys major portions of all three of America's electrical grids, the West Coast grid, the East Coast grid, and the Texas grid, all at once. As a result, one after the next, the nation's system of interconnected extra-high-voltage transformers begins to fail. When the pulse hits, it sends the equipment out of control, out of sync, says Toohill. It's the EMP collateral effects that are the problem. Across the United States, these collateral effects are apocalyptic. Electric Armageddon unfurls. 21st century America is a complex system of systems, powered by electricity and engineered with microprocessing chips. The nation's approximately 11,000 utility-scale electric power plants, 22,000 generators, and 55,000 substations experience a massive, calamitous, cascade-type failure. Huge swaths of America's 642,000 miles of high-voltage transmission lines and its 6.3 million miles of distribution lines begin to shut down. The nation's transportation system is crippled near simultaneously. Of America's 280 million registered vehicles, 10% of the vehicles on the road are suddenly not running anymore, EMP Commissioner Dr. William Graham warned the Senate Armed Services Committee in 2008, long before America's cars and trucks were engineered with so many electronic microprocessing components. Without power steering or electric brakes, vehicles coast to a stop or crash into other vehicles, into buildings, into walls. Stalled and crashed vehicles block lanes of traffic on roads and bridges everywhere, no longer just in places where people have been fleeing nuclear bombs, but in tunnels and on overpasses, on big and small roads, in driveways, and in parking lots across the nation. There is pandemonium everywhere. America is already under nuclear attack. There is no way to flee, no way to escape. Being stuck in a countrywide traffic jam without any electric power effects is a nightmare for millions of travelers. But a far more devastating sequence of events is underway and cannot be stopped. America's control system architecture begins to fail. The real problem with EMP, physicist and architect of the Ivy Mike thermonuclear device Richard Garwin tells us, are SCADA systems going down. Garwin's seminal 1954 paper on EMP is still classified. SCADA stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition, a computer-based, human-interfaced control system architecture that gathers and analyzes industrial equipment information across America's critical infrastructure sectors, then delivers that information to the people working within the system, allowing them to do their jobs. SCADA going down becomes an instant out-of-control nightmare, says Yago. SCADA systems supervise the logic controllers that interface with machinery at every major and minor industrial plant across the United States. SCADA systems control railroad routers, lift gates on dams, gas and oil refinery transmissions, assembly lines, air traffic control, port facilities, fiber optics,